So here we are, we've come to a very important juncture in the development of this monastery. And in a couple of days' time, we have three new novices. And Venerable Mahesi will become the first ever person to take full ordination at this monastery. And so it's a very... It's like a point or an act or an event which, whose significance we can't really grasp. Something which, in a sense, goes beyond our kind of normal categories. Like we can look at things like, for example, we've been building the monastery and we can build a kuti or something like that, and we can say, well, that's something that's finite. It's something that's fairly comprehensible. It's a building. Uses certain materials, took a certain amount of time, cost a certain amount of money, and provides certain kinds of facilities. And so that's a kind of, there's something in a sense, there's something defined about that. But what the result is of, you know, bringing people here to ordain, to actually give their lives to going forth, to give their lives to practice of the Eightfold Path, it's something that can't be measured or encompassed within these kinds of ordinary categories. The Buddha said that when a young monk who goes forth, a young bhikkhu goes forth and is filled with metta, practicing metta very often, then they illuminate this world like the full moon, which is freed from the cloud. So that's really the only kind of way that we can use to understand this. Through metaphor and simile. So a young bhikkhu who ordains illuminates the world like a full moon released from the clouds. Of course, when he said young bhikkhu, he also meant bhikkhunis, but it didn't fit into the meter. So he had to make it rhyme or whatever. So it's the same. And, you know, we kind of look at things as if they're... We have this very kind of worldly or kind of mechanistic way of looking at things as if they are kind of in some way comparable. My intention was brought to this a few days ago when I was reading something by some of the Anglican bishops, because when I went to this service in the Anglican Cathedral a few weeks ago, and the head there, Peter Jensen, gave a talk which I found in some ways quite problematic. Not merely because I'm not a Christian, but also because I felt that the way he was presenting Christianity was very, in some ways, very crude and inappropriate. And so I wanted to check out like how that related, and I've been looking at some of the other much more sophisticated Anglican thinkers like Peter Carnley and, what's his name, the English Archbishop. And he recently made some headlines because he said that creationism shouldn't be taught in schools. And that was quite an interesting thing to say. And he made the point, which I think is very valid, that when you do that, then you kind of make the idea that creation, the idea that God created the universe or the world, is a kind of a theory alongside other theories which may be proven or disproven, whereas in fact it's an act of faith and it's not something which is a theory. And so he thought that idea of say teaching creationism in schools was like a category mistake. It's the wrong kind of thing. It's not the kind of thing which you call a scientific theory. And I think the same kind of thing we make often when we're thinking about Buddhism and the going forth. It's something which I've kind of often noticed, but I haven't been not sure if I've been able to really articulate it very clearly. But like the going forth is not like a way of life which you can choose alongside other ways of lives. I mean, obviously, in one sense it is, but it's in another very important sense it's not. For example, one way of expressing this in Buddha's terms is that the Buddha always talked about the four castes in ancient India, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the warriors, the Vaisas, the merchants, and the Sudras, the working class. And then, of course, the Samanas, the ones who had gone forth, constituted their own caste. They were outside of that system. It was something else. And when I was in Malaysia, I always remember one time this very extremely diligent practitioner who was there was said to me, came up to me one time, and she was saying, you know, this lady was so diligent in her practice. She used to walking meditation on sharp rocks in the middle of the night to keep herself awake. These kinds of things. So, you know, she was really out there. She came and said, "Oh, you know, how we think is that we're going to work and earn a lot of money, and then we can afford to pay to go on retreat." And she kind of looked at me and she said, "That's not right, is it?" I said, "No, it's not right. This is a kind of worldly way of thinking, that you can, you know, first of all, make money, go into the world, get your stuff, and then you can use it for what you want, and that's often what we want to do." And so we see, like, the Buddhism is like a Buddhist retreat is like an option along other kinds of options. So, you know, you can have a holiday, time can come up, and you can decide, well, I want to do a Buddhist retreat for this holiday. Last year we went to Fiji, and the year before that we drove a caravan out to Ayers Rock. And this year I think we'll go on a Buddhist retreat. And it sort of becomes like another option that you can do. Or you can say, well, you know, I'm going to allocate this part of my life to my Dhamma practice. So I'm going to put my Dhamma in this kind of category. So again, I think all of these kinds of things are based on a very kind of limited and worldly apprehension of what the nature of Dhamma is. And in some sense, there is some sense in which we have to acknowledge that the reach of Dhamma, that the scale of Dhamma, the scope of it, is something which is really beyond us. And we have to be important that, sorry, we have to acknowledge the importance of not overestimating the power of our reason and intellect in understanding the Dhamma. As we were reminded when we did the reading the other day in the Vinaya class, and we read that the Buddha said two things especially deep and profound. One of them is dependent origination, the other one Nibbana. And these things are both atakavachara, beyond the sphere of thought, beyond the sphere of reason. So there's an important sense in which the scope of that truth of Dhamma, what is suffering, what is the ending of suffering, there's an important sense in which that still eludes us. It doesn't elude us absolutely, because of course we all have the aspiration to realize enlightenment, and once we have realized enlightenment, then we will know these things, we will understand them. But until that time, there's always some degree of faith. So this is why when it talks about, in the suttas, as it talks about going forth, it always says, one who's gone forth out of faith. And that's based on like a limited conception of the Dhamma. And as you know, the stock passage, it talks about somebody who hears the teachings, and then they reflect to themselves, seems that it's not easy while living in the home life to live the perfectly purified spiritual life. It doesn't say it's impossible, but naidang sukarang, it's not an easy thing to do. The life in the home is crowded, and the life gone forth is wide open. So these things are very important for us to keep on reflecting about. That life, the home life, is very crowded with possessions, with responsibilities, with wishes, with expectations, all of those kinds of things. The life gone forth is wide open. So it's not something which is easily defined and pinned down. This, of course, is one of the paradoxes of the monk's life, because in some senses, of course, we are pinned down. We have very clear guidelines from Vinaya and so on, and they tell us in very many things, they tell us exactly what to do and what not to do, and so we have those very clear, quite stringent guidelines, ethical guidelines for our conduct. What you'll find is the more that you live with the Vinaya, the more that it kind of sinks into your bones, the more that it becomes not something that you have to worry about, but it becomes more something that becomes natural to you, that this kind of way of life in fact opens up so many things, and opens up so many possibilities. So we think of the rules of Vinaya, the rules of the monastic discipline. It's a bit like when you learn how to drive a car, when you're first doing your learners, you have to drive around, you have to remember, okay, I drive on the left side of the road, I have to put my indicator on before so many meters before I turn, I have to turn indicate to the left at 90 degrees when I'm coming out of a roundabout, and I have to do all of these kinds of things. But then after you've been driving for a few years, you don't give the slightest bit of attention to any of those things. You just get in the car and drive. And you just naturally keep all the road rules. And that actually gives you a lot of freedom. So this is what the kind of freedom which the bhikkhu's life or the bhikkhuni's life gives us, is that kind of freedom to drive along the Eightfold Path, I guess, to extend the metaphor in directions which I hadn't thought of when I first used it. And so we don't have to be thinking, okay, right, only 7 days I can use my chocolate, and can I use Coffee Mate in the afternoon or not, and do I have to get my fruit juice strained, and all of these kinds of things, and oh my God, am I in the Sema or not at dawn on the seventh day of the 13th full moon, and whatever it may be, and all of those kinds of things. You don't have to worry too much about it. You can still, you know, learn them and pay attention to them, but we don't have to kind of worry about them. That's more like a thing of refinement. But the basic vinaya, the basic qualities of the samana, especially, they are things which really sink into your bones. And this is where they have to live, not on a page, not in our head. They live in your bones, in your marrow. And the core of the samana sila, the way of life, actually is not even found really in the Vinaya. The core of it is found in the suttas, in places like the Attikavagga and the the Silakandavagga in the Digha Nikaya. And these are places that really express the fundamentals of what the holy life is about. So there's some sense in which practicing in this way brings about a transformation. There's some sense in which there's like curbs that are placed, curbs on our bodily action, curbs on our speech. And those things tend to move our minds in a certain direction. Not necessarily very quickly, but it will happen very, very gradually, little bit by little bit by little bit. And something happens to people when they're ordained for a long time. And that's certainly something that I've seen since I've been a bhikkhu, that almost everybody has changed. They've changed drastically in the time that I've known them. And a lot of people who, when they came along to the monastery and ordained, had a lot of very, very strong defilements and problems, and now I see them many years later, and you know, just think how much they've grown, how much they've matured, how much they've become spiritually more kind of whole and worthy people. And this is the real test of the holy life. If I didn't see this around me, and if I didn't see it in myself, then, you know, if I didn't see it in myself, I wouldn't be a monk anymore. If I had seen after 2 or 3 years of being a monk that it was a waste of time and was useless, then I would have just disrobed. But I didn't see that. I looked in there and I thought, wow, this is really working. And believe it or not, I used to be even worse than I am now. Doesn't mean that I'm talking about any kind of perfection or even competence, but just sort of at least some kind of movement in the right direction. And that is one thing that we notice as monks, that very often the people who come along to monasteries, you know, very often we do meet people who are very rough. They have a lot of problems. There are people who come along who have psychological problems. There are people who come along who've been gangsters or drug addicts or many kinds of things. And they all come along. People who've been suicidal before coming along to the monastery. But they come and they tough it out. They suffer a lot. Some people come along and their life is very smooth. You think, wow, they walk into the door and they're enlightened already. And They've got a very kind of noble character. They can sit and meditate and it's very easy. And these kinds of things. But that's a fairly small minority. Most of us have got a lot of struggling to do. A lot of pain. A lot of those nights when you can't just can't concentrate your mind at all. Your mind filled with the black clouds of sleepiness. And you have to force yourself late at night to go onto the walking path and force yourself to stagger up and down the walking path until just to try and keep yourself awake for a little bit longer. And many, many times when you're just going to have to face those moments when your meditation finishes, you open your eyes, you get to move out of meditation, and then you're thinking, hang on, what am I finishing my meditation for? It's just restlessness. And you realize actually you're just being motivated by restlessness. Many, many times when you're going to do things, say things to other monks or other people, and then afterwards you reflect on that and you'll cringe. You think, oh my God, how did I say that? And you have to live with the pain of that. And then sometimes you're going to have to go and find that monk and ask for forgiveness for what you've done and say sorry. You're going to have to learn how to do that a lot. Make it easy for you to say those things. And so there's this gradual movement or shift that happens in people's mind because of this lifestyle. As you know, in Buddhism, one of the great controversies is about sudden versus gradual enlightenment. And some people talk about sudden enlightenment. They're kind of the Zen masters. Suddenly they'll bang you with a stick. And boom, you get enlightened right there. Or like the bhikkhuni who wanted to hang herself. Sort of tied the rope around the tree. After 20 years wandering, tie the noose, hang it around the tree, and she's about to put her head into the noose. She's about to step off. And then boom, suddenly her mind becomes free. So this is kind of model of like sudden enlightenment. But the main thing the Buddha talked about always was gradual practice. This kind of gradual wearing away. The similes he used, like the simile of the axe handle, like as if you're using an axe and you know you can come out for one day and use the axe and chop the wood, you come out the next day and use it to chop the wood and the handle looks pretty much the same. But if you do that every day and you come out after a year, then you see, oh, actually the handle's worn away this much. Or the simile of the ships and the ship's rigging. And again, the same kind of idea, but you don't see from one day to the next that the ship's rigging has changed at all. But each night the dew moistens the rigging and the cold gets into that. And then in the daytime the sun heats it up and expands it and dries it. And when it's constantly being moistened and dried out like that, eventually it'll give way. And so the same with the practice of meditation. And the commentary gives a very nice explanation of that and just sort of describes the cool moisture in the evening is like the coolness of samatha meditation. Moistening the mind, making it very soft and supple. And then the heat during the daytime is like the heat of vipassana, the heat of deep insight. It's drying the mind out. And so these things working gradually, one after the other in a pair. And that's what will weaken those bonds, those fetters that hold your mind. So these are the kinds of ways that the Buddha would usually talk about practice. And so even though that moment of enlightenment will happen very suddenly. It'll happen like a flash of lightning in a dark night. But the course leading up to that, the way leading up to that, it's very gradual. It's very subtle. And very often it happens in ways that we don't know. Even if we're practicing, we don't actually see what's going on. We don't even understand within ourselves. Whereabouts are our own defilements being reduced? Where are they being increased? Where are they being just hidden away, ready to erupt at a later time? So these are things which we don't know kind of naturally and automatically. They're things that we only know after a long time, after repeated practice, repeated reviewing, repeated reflection, and gradually learning about ourselves. So this path of going forth, being the one who's gone forth, is not something, don't think that it will be unproblematic or easy or anything like that. Of course it will be. Of course it will be filled with ambiguities and problems and difficulties. And as you know, I've always said that it's normal that if you get, say, half a dozen anagarikas like we had at the beginning of the rains, it is normal that half of them will leave before novice ordination, and so that's what's happened. But then it's also normal that then half of the novices will lead before bhikkhu ordination. So we've got three novices, that means we'll have 1.5 bhikkhus. And then of the ones who ordain as bhikkhus, then about half of them will make it through the first 5 years. So that'll be 0.75 bhikkhus we'll have, and so on. So I mean, the fact that people come and go from the holy life in a sense is not a problem. You know, that's the Buddha made it like that. So, you know, that's normal. People come and people go. It's not necessarily a sign of anything's wrong. That doesn't mean there's something wrong with the person or that something's wrong with the place or anything like that. But it just means there's not kind of a fit. There's not like a fit with the lifestyle. There's not that kind of deep vocation is not there yet. So that's okay. We shouldn't think, you know, we shouldn't think that disrobing is something shameful or wrong. Of course, it's something which, you know, you just, if you make that choice, then you have to try to live your life as best you can. But in this monastery, as you know, we don't ordain people who want to just try it out for a little while and see. We don't do temporary ordinations. As I have been asked that before, people have asked if they can do temporary ordinations here, and I said no. Only for those who sincerely want to dedicate their lives to this holy life, to this practice of Dhamma. And so I don't think any of us really understand what this means any more than we can understand the simile that the Buddha gave, that the young bhikkhu who practices metta will illuminate the world like the full moon released from the clouds. How can we understand this? How can we understand the power of this radiance of metta that one can develop? How can we understand that power of that level of virtue and aspiration to live the holy life for the ending of suffering? If you remember in the Chula Gosengabhut Sutta, and there was a very beautiful story of the three monks, Anuruddha, Kimbila and Nandiya, and they were staying in the Gosengabhut forest, and as they were staying there, then the Buddha came to visit them. And when they came in, the Buddha came in to visit them, the monastery attendant saw the Buddha and said, "Hold it, mate, you can't come in here." And then the monks heard him and said, "Oh no, that's alright, it's not him, it's the Buddha. He's allowed to come in." So that's how secluded they were, that they wouldn't even allow other monks to come in and disturb them in their meditation. So of course when they knew it was the Buddha, they invited him and had some discussion with him about their practice. And it's a very, very inspiring example of the holy life. You know, and here we see, you know, not the kind of the legalisms of the Vinaya. The Vinaya tells us very often hypothetical cases of what can happen when things go wrong. So in the Vinaya is always using this kind of optative case, you know, like, should this thing happen, or should any bhikkhu do such and such, then this is what will go on. It's like this hypothetical, and because it's hypothetical, actually in many cases they don't really occur, because they only are relevant when somebody breaks them. Just like any other law, we remain ignorant of most of the laws of our country because simply we're not in a position to break them, so we don't break them. They don't really affect us. And a lot of the Vinaya is like that. A lot of the Vinaya is rules and principles which we kind of know in the back of our mind, but which, you know, they don't actually occur as such, simply because we don't go near them, we don't approach that kind of behavior. And so when we look at the Chula Gosenga Sutta, then that's talking about what do the monks actually do? How do they actually live? And, you know, they're going out for alms round, they prepare the place for eating when they come back, set out the foot washing water, and the water for washing the bowls and so on. They sit and they have their meal. When they finish, they clean it all up and they work together in harmony. If they need to cooperate to do things, then they do so quietly. And just this very beautiful picture of monks living together in harmony. And they says there that they are three in body but one in mind, and regarding each other with eyes of metta, rather with loving kindness. And thinking, whenever they think of what they want to do, then they think, well, why don't I put aside what I want to do and do what these other venerables want to do? And they don't just think that, they then actually put it into practice. They actually put aside what they want to do and do what the other venerables want to do. So it's a very beautiful picture of how we can aspire to live together. Not like a series of prohibitions, the things that we can't do, the series of rules which we have to be careful of breaking, but that aspiration, that sense of lifting up and saying, how can I possibly live my life as a monk in the best possible way? What can I aspire to? How can I live this life in the most beautiful way, the most beneficial way, the most perfect way? And this is really the aspiration that fuels the holy life. Everything else really is just kind of management issues. It's what you do to sort of get along, to make things work, to be practical. But always bear in mind that aspiration. And so this lifestyle has that very high, very pure aspiration. And if we remember in the earliest formula for going forth, is not the Nyati Chututtakamma that we'll be doing on Monday. The earliest going forth was the Ehibhikkhu ordination, Kambhikkhu. And so when we say Ehibhikkhu or Ehibhikkhuni, then that's a very different kind of emotional response. It's like a calling out. It's a sense of vocation and calling out. The Dhamma is well expounded. Live the holy life for the ending of suffering. It's very simple. The Dhamma is well explained. Live the holy life for the ending of suffering. That's all that really matters. So when you do your novice ordination on Monday, the bit that's really important is not so much even the Namo Tassa or the Buddhang Saranangacchami or the Panatipata Viramani. The really important thing is the Sambhadukha Nisarana Nibbana Satchikaranataya, for the escaping of all suffering. Sambhadukha Nisarana, that is Nibbana, for the realization of the escape of all suffering, that is Nibbana. That's really the most important thing. This is the aspiration that lifts this holy life up, and that's the aspiration which changes. It gives this transcendental dimension to the whole holy life and to what we're doing here. That means it's not just, we're not just a hippie commune. We're not just a bunch of anarchists. And there's nothing wrong with anarchy. I think the Vinaya is an anarchist document. I think anarchy is very good. But we're not just a bunch of anarchists. We're not just business people, even though we're running the monastery, we have to enter into business arrangements with people to get things done, but we're not a business. We're not trying to make profit. We're not coming up with any product that you can like evaluate or compare with other products. Of course, Ajahn Brahm always jokes about that his monastery is like a monk factory, as if you can kind of stamp out monks at the end of the day. And fair enough, it's a joke, but it's important to remember exactly how misleading that is as a joke. Because ordinations are very easy to do. We could ordain a lot of you if we wanted to right now. Just about. We need one more monk. We're missing one monk to do it. But anyway, even it's only a dukkha offense even if you've got four monks. That's the one for the veneer experts. But anyway, we get the point. We can certainly give you all the going forth. We've got enough roads downstairs. Razor blades. And give people a real surprise on Monday when they came. And for some of you, it would give your husbands or your wives a big surprise as well. So it's easy to do. It only takes really 5 minutes if you want to do it. And you can use cheat notes. There's nothing in the Vinaya that says you can't use cheat notes when you're doing your chanting. And all of these kinds of things. So we try to do it in a slightly more dignified fashion. But the reality is that the procedures are very simple. And if we wanted to just sort of get people in and churn out lots of monks, then we could do that. But of course, that's not the point. Since I've been living here and kind of thinking about this place as a monastery, then, you know, it's always been part of my conception that we will be performing ordinations when the time comes. Not that I've never had any kind of program for that. As you know, we don't like organize novitiate courses or sort of advertise, you know, wanted bhikkhus. Must be restrained and mindful. So we haven't been kind of doing that, but I always think that it's part of our responsibility as Sangha. You know, we have that gratitude towards our teachers because they went to the trouble of setting up a monastery that we could live. When I was in Thailand, and you know, I just rolled in the front door of Wat Nanachat one day with my backpack on and my guitar in my hand, and just walked into the sala just before the monks going out on Pindavata, and they kind of looked at me as if I was some kind of weirdo hippie, which I was. And they gave me food that very day. I didn't have to do anything. They gave me food, even sticky rice. And then they gave me a place to stay. And they even gave me a cup of coffee in the afternoons. It was very kind. And teachings and support and encouragement. And yet I never had a feeling that anyone was trying to, get me or capture me or anything like that. There was no kind of feeling of coercion or anything. It was very, very free and very open. And that was one of the ways that I knew I could trust it, because there wasn't that feeling of coercion, but it was a feeling of mutual trust. Rather, it wasn't like cult-like, and that no one was saying they wanted to take all my money from me or anything like that. And so, you know, I always had gratitude for my teachers for providing me with that opportunity, for teaching me Dhamma, teaching me Vinaya, providing me a place to stay, making sure that there was food, and all of those kinds of things. That's what's made it possible for me to be a monk. The only way I can think of to repay that debt is to then do the same thing for the next generation as well, to try to also provide the opportunity, provide the teaching, provide the place to stay, and everything that's needed for the practice of the holy life. But of course, what I can't supply, what I can't provide, is the stuff that's really important. I can't supply enlightenment. I can't supply the Eightfold Path. I can't supply the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. They're not things which can be transmitted from teacher to teacher or from teacher to student. There's no kind of lineage of that. That's something which is up to each person when they come here to practice and realize for themselves. And that's, of course, what really gives the heart to it. We can do everything else if we want. We can have the kutis, we can have the class, Dhamma classes, we can have the books, all of those things. We can have people staying here, offerings of dana, but it can be completely pointless, it can be completely without a soul, if the people staying here aren't sincere in their practice. And if the people are sincere in their practice, then really the other things sort of fade into insignificance. So this is what, you know, I want to try to get you all to develop, like this samana sanya, this perception or this point of view, this perspective of being a samana, of one who's gone forth, being the point of view of someone who's just content with little, content with any old rag robe at all, content with any old alms food at all, content with any old dwelling place at all, content with any old gall nuts pickled in fermented cow's urine at all for medicine. And so if you come along and you say, oh, Bhante, I'm really sick, I need to go to the doctor, and if I give you some fermented gall nuts pickled in fermented cow's urine, we've got plenty of cows nearby, what are you going to do? Think about it. This is what the life gone forth is dependent on. What's going to happen? Oh, that's not a bad idea, actually. I might just go over to the farmers now and see if I can borrow some. This is like your heritage. This is your inheritance, okay? And so there'll always be something for you, okay? So we'll always have a tree root for you to stay at. And I can guarantee you, absolutely, all right? As long as you stay at Santi Monastery, you will always have a tree root. And that you can even have your own tree root. You don't even have to share your tree roots, okay? There's enough for one for everybody. And that much I'll guarantee you. At least we'll guarantee that there'll be some rags for you to wear. And at least we'll guarantee that we can go for alms, and almost always there'll be somebody to put a little bit of food in the bowl when we go for alms in the village. And as for the gall nuts pickled in fermented cow's urine, I don't even know if I can guarantee that. I have to find a willing cow first. But this is this is the bottom line. This is what you go forth independence of. So we don't go forth in the expectation of laptops. This is not something which we can sort of guarantee as part of the holy life. We don't go forth in the expectation of business class tickets to travel where we want to go. We don't go forth in the expectation of having cheesecake at the mealtime. These are not things which are part of the deal. These are things which, if they come along, then they come along, and we should use them mindfully and understanding the dangers. So this is what the Buddha said is the difference between a Patujana, an unenlightened person, and a noble one. Is that both of them may receive beautiful things. Both of them may get good things to use, good robes, Kashmir shawls, or whatever it may be. But the Patujana, the unenlightened person, when they get those things, then they just delight in it and indulge in it and get attached to it. And because they do that, then when those things change, when those things deteriorate, when those things fall apart, then they get sad, they get upset, they get depressed. Whereas the enlightened person will always reflect that this is impermanent. This is subject to change. This is not going to last forever. This is something that's not perfect. And so when they reflect in that way, then they use their requisites wisely. And when the requisites don't live up to their expectations, then they don't get upset. Because that's what happens. You have a Kashmir shawl and you use it in winter and you still get cold. You have delicious cheesecake to eat at lunch and then afterwards you get a stomachache. You have a nice kuti to live in and you think everything's going to be fine, and then even though you've done everything you can, but still somehow the mosquito gets in there and is bothering you all night. So these things, it's always the case. It's always how it will be. So it's somehow because of these expectations. This is why holy life in some ways is like the opposite of the worldly life, the patisotagamani, the going against the stream of the world. And so whereas if you want to get a job, you get a job only if you have a contract. You think, well, I'm going to get a certain amount of money per year. And then when you think that, then you think, well, with that money I can do this and that and the other. I can go on a holiday, I can buy some furniture, I can buy some clothes, whatever you want to do with that money. Whereas in life gone forth, we don't do it with those kinds of expectations. And so somehow it's that unconditional giving up, that kind of direction of life which is like constantly like saying no and constantly moving in that other way. In that way, away from engagement, away from attachment, away from grasping, away from getting, and constantly moving that way away, then this is somewhere in there is like the holiness or the sacredness of the holy life. Somewhere in there there's that special thing which is which creates that power. And that power is very visible, which moves people. Like when we do the ordination on Monday, we're going to have people will be coming to visit. They'll come and drive down a long way to come and see this. It's like a change of life. They don't do that if somebody gets a job. You don't have like 50 or 100 people coming along and celebrating the fact that you've got a new job. They don't do that if you buy a new car. They might do it for like very significant change of life ceremonies, like a christening or a wedding or something like that. So in a way it's a bit more like those kinds of things. But the actual going forth ceremony, as has been studied in modern times, a lot of the details of that actually mirror the or mimic the details of funeral ceremonies in ancient India, like the shaving of the head and the putting on of rags and things like that. These kinds of things are what they do to corpses before they bury them. So this is how in the holy life, it's not so much a birthday as a death day you're celebrating. So it's kind of good practice, because normally you don't get to go to your own funeral. Whereas going to an ordination ceremony is like being able to go to your own funeral. And because of course the way of life which you knew, the person which you knew before has died. And something else, like the phoenix has risen from the flames. And so that something else is a person who's not intent on getting more of samsara, but the person who's intent of getting out of samsara. So this is what sometimes I phrase that, like when we talk about Buddhism these days, we always talk about applying Buddhism to daily life. As if we've got our lives are there, and then somehow we're going to bring a bit of Buddhism in and put that in our lives, you know, like as if we were going to put a bowl of tulips there to make it look nicer, or kind of redecorate or something like that. And we can take the same basic building and redecorate it with Buddhist colours, but the actual thing itself hasn't really changed. But what we're doing here is not applying Buddhism to daily life, but applying daily life to Buddhism, applying our daily life to the Dhamma, so that every moment, every breath becomes a breath of Dhamma. Every time, you know, as a lay person, for example, you might sweep the driveway of your house, and then, you know, like it's your house. You are sweeping your house because it's yours. Or you go and sweep somebody else's driveway because they pay you for it. But here in the monastery, we don't do that. We sweep the driveway because it belongs to the Sangha, because it's an offering to the Sangha. It's an offering to those who are our fellows in the holy life, because it's something that we can give. It's a service that we can give freely. So everything that we do in that way is an offering. Everything. Every time you close the door with mindfulness, so you close the door quietly, then that's an offering to everybody else who's in the house. Every time that you put your bowl away quickly after the meal and walk off back to the forest quickly without getting involved in socializing and chit-chat, then that's an offering to everybody in the monastery. It's an offering of your seclusion. Every time that you have a kind word to say, then that's like offering that feeling of community and support in the monastery. Every time if you're asked to do a job at chores time, every time you do that job with full attention and full composure and full understanding, so that you do the job well, and then that's an offering to the Sangha. It's not something you do for yourself. It's not something you do for your job. It's something you do for the Sangha. For this idea we have of the Sangha is something infinite. So this is why the Buddha said that, like an offering to the Sangha, it's of infinite benefit. You can't measure it. Because the whole Sangha, the whole institution, the whole way of life is orientated towards that, I guess, that infinite, that measureless goal of Nibbana. And so everything we can do to support that measureless goal, then that becomes measureless itself. So we should always reflect on this holy life as being something which is quite unique and quite precious. It's not like an option among other options. It's not something you don't just kind of walk down the supermarket shelf and think, I'm going to choose becoming a monk rather than becoming a mechanic. It's something which stands outside all the other ways of life, and stands outside the normal categories of what people think of in society. And that's why it has that power. That's why it has the power to move people. And in a sense, you become like public figures. You belong to the Buddhist community as a whole, in a certain sense. You know, so that's why, you know, you don't get hold of some money and go to the casino or something like that. And people see you and think, what's going on? Like when I was in Thailand, and one of the man who was looking after me said that when he went to Japan, he was watching TV one night, and there was a game show, and there was a monk on the game show. He was very shocked. So we don't do those kinds of things, because in a sense we belong to everyone. We're not just private individuals anymore. Your acts reflect on Buddhism, they reflect on the Sangha. And because we all wear the same robe, we all have the same haircut, so people will generalize your behavior. If people come here and they see you doing a certain thing, then they'll go away and they won't say, you know, Santi Dhammo's like this, or Sujato's like that, or Payavata's like that. They'll say, oh, the monks in the monastery are like this, the monks in the monastery are like that. And that's what they will see. So we just have to be very careful. This is like this gift which is handed to you, which you have to treat very as if it's very precious, and treat it with a lot of care and a lot of tenderness. So this is all I had to say for this evening on the going forth, the meaning of going forth. I offer that to you for your reflection.